This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon, and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
All right, good morning, and welcome to another edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour, brought to you by the continually corporate-free KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Ivan Hale, and our engineer today is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour is one of the many locally and voluntarily produced programs brought to you by this radio station. We are not syndicated nationwide, but we bring you news and commentary, movie and book reviews from a national, international perspective. We are a collective, choosing to find power in our diversity and at times differing opinions. By utilizing this dissonance, we are able to strengthen our cohesion and offer up each week challenging, thoughtful, provocative, and revolutionary ideas to stimulate your Monday morning and move with you in your day with whatever personal revolutions you choose to impart. Kicking off our show this morning, senior analyst Bill Resnick talks with Roan Carey about the latest Israeli-Palestine peace talks. Kara Douglas opines on Trayvon Martin and the new Jim Crow. And Paul Rowland rounds it out today with more discussions on the power of community radio. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned.
Come hither. Let me send a shiver down your spine as a rhyme in the name of Palestine. I'll make you quiver. As I deliver these powerful lines, we demand justice for Zionist crimes. We demand you dismantle your colonial prize. Palestine has been murdered too many times. Come close. Let me expose your never-ending lies. You call them foes, but those were innocent lives. Show remorse. As you feel the full force of our cries, we demand Israel's final demise. You talk of peace while Palestine dies. Hear this, there is no compromise. Come, let me send a chill across your silky skin as I reveal your each and every sin. Kneel as we begin. For the ice beneath your feet is extremely thin. You steal our land and kill our kin in the name of Hitler's every war-torn victim. Yet there's a hollow ring to these words that you spin. For the leaders that you believe in were terrorizing Palestine while Jewish children were suffering. From Ben-Gurion to Begin, Zionism is the enemy within. Come near. Let's be clear about your imperialist ideology. You're merely America's tiny little prodigy. You better fear. Because we require much more than an apology. Withdraw the oil empire and remove your racist theology. We're 5 million refugees with Jerusalem as our destiny. Hatal Nasr, by any means necessary.
Ron Carey, welcome to KABU.
Hello, Bill. Nice to talk to you.
Ron Carey is the managing editor of The Nation magazine. He edited the book, The New Intifada. He co-edited the book, The Other Israel, Voices of Refusal and Dissent. And he's contributed numerous short pieces to The Nation and other publications. So, Ron Carey, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators are meeting this evening in Washington, D.C., to discuss arrangements for resuming the Israel-Palestine, what's called the peace talks or peace process. Why is this happening now? What do you expect?
It's happening now, I think, for several reasons. The key one is that is simply that since there have been no talks for 2 or 3 years, Washington is getting increasingly nervous and knows that no talks eventually results in violence, and I think they feel the need to have at least a semblance of negotiations. The fact is that the Oslo peace process died over a decade ago. It died with the opening of the Second Intifada, and all observers know this. But in the absence of anything else, there is, you know, there's a policy vacuum, and so the pretense, the need to keep this pretense going, the need to keep the idea that they can have a negotiated solution to the conflict that will result in a Palestinian state, states living side by side, there really is, Washington has no alternative to that idea, even though the idea has been dying for years. So that's why they need to keep this going. They put immense pressure on the Palestinians to agree to talks, even though the main condition the Palestinians put on a revival of talks, namely freeze and settlements by the Israelis have refused to abide by. And Washington and the Clinton administration at first tried to put pressure on Israel to agree to those terms, but the government of Bibi Netanyahu refused, and Obama backed down. And then after a silence of a couple of years now, they're turning around, and instead of trying to get the Israelis to agree to that, they have put immense pressure on the Palestinians to enter talks, and they've basically done so through a combination of bribes and threats. They've offered them an enormous amount of aid, and they've also said that if you don't do this, then we will make your lives increasingly difficult. And they've tried to square the circle also by, trying to make statements to them that will not sound like intimidation, but that's basically what they're doing.
You know, when I think of it, there was a time when I sort of believed that there was some possibility of the peace process, and the U.S. was actually interested in pursuing it because it was so destabilizing in the Middle East. Arguments for that seem to me to be getting weaker and weaker, actually. It may well be that the status quo, I mean, what's been happening for the last, 30 years, is right now, from the sort of the U.S. military's perspective, about the best they can do. And in fact, the U.S. may in fact be interested in just prolonging the agony of the Palestinians as a way of maintaining this enormous nuclear-armed and extremely loyal to the United States, except when it takes sort of freelance action, or at least action that appears to be freelance. It's never quite clear, like bombing of Syria or bombing of Iran and the last time around, or of Iraq. It may well be that in U.S. strategic calculations, the Israeli military is a tremendous asset for them in the Middle East in protecting the dictatorial states like Saudi Arabia. And they like the status quo, which means why not have a sort of failed peace negotiations every couple of years to make it appear as if you're, in fact, pursuing peace. Is that a possible sort of set of motivations within the United States, within the United States hierarchy?
I don't think the geostrategic thinkers, and I don't think the military in the U.S. actually like the status quo. They know it's unstable. But I think part of what you said is true, which is that Israel is one of the all-important allies of the U.S. in the Middle East, and is determined to maintain that relationship. And when it comes to strategic interests, the basic rights of Palestinians are far less important to the power centers in Washington than maintaining the alliance with Israel. And so they're willing to sacrifice minimal conditions of justice for Palestinians. They don't love it because they know that it's destabilizing. I think they actually understand that keeping several million Palestinians in a state of subjugation is immensely destabilizing and could be dangerous. And I think they also know, just as many Israelis know, that if there is not a just solution to this conflict, then eventually the basic survival of Israel is at stake. Mm-hmm. If you think of Israel as, you know, as fundamentally the Zionist state presence in Palestine, then obviously if a Palestinian state is impossible and Israel solidifies and eventually annexes the West Bank, then it's impossible to maintain Israel as a Zionist state. Israeli leaders know this. Israeli oppositionists know this. The U.S. government knows this. So it's destabilizing. So in that sense, I don't think they welcome it. It's just that they don't have the willingness to put the necessary pressure on Israel to do something about it. If they really cared about Israel and they wanted to maintain the long-term security of Israel, then they would understand that as part of that, they need to find a just they need to answer the national rights of Palestinians, and they would put pressure on Israel to withdraw all of its settlements from the West Bank and agree to a genuine two-state solution with genuine Palestinian sovereignty, with control over East Jerusalem. That's really the only possible two-state solution. But I think, as it stands now, the U.S. government is simply not willing to put the pressure on Israel to do that. So the result is de facto willingness to go along with Israel's steady encroachment in the West Bank and really the dissolution of any possibility of a two-state solution. Yeah.
Before we get to the steady encroachment, I think it's important to remind people of Israeli policy for the past 50 years and how dreadful and murderous it is to the Palestinians. Today, it seems that everything you said is correct in terms of the long term. In terms of the short term now, things are so destabilized in the Middle East with the Arab Spring, with the Islamic thrust. It's not clear what it amounts to and which brand of Islamic governance is the favored, will prevail. And some of them it seems to me, very fearsome, actually. It seems to me that having a highly armed Israel with nuclear weapons and ready to threaten Iran and to threaten that, you know, the Shiite sort of awakening, like in Bahrain and other places, it seems to me that's quite useful to the U.S. And without the Israeli forces now, the U.S. would really be in much, much worse shape in trying to shape the Middle East than they are would be without them. And it seems that, you know, the Israeli military has considerable, at least, and the Israeli right has a huge amount of support, it seems to me, in the Congress of the United States in particular, because of that strategic position. especially now. In the long run, of course, they would like to stabilize. How do you like that hypothesis?
Well, yes, of course, the Israeli government and military has overwhelming support in Congress. Pretty much anything it wants, Congress will go along with. I mean, that has as much to do with the power of the AIPAC lobby as it does with actual strategic calculations by members of Congress. I think when it comes to U.S. military strategists, yes, they see great value in the alliance with Israel. But it's often a value that's very hard to actualize, because they know that Israel as a player in the Middle East is considered toxic by all of the Arab nations. And just to take one example, Iran and Shiite influence throughout the Middle East, Israel is keenly interested in America fighting a war with Iran. I mean, it's very clear that it's pushing for this, and it's doing everything it can to get America to increase tensions so that America will fight a war with Iran, because Israel sees its major enemy as a potentially nuclear-armed Iranian state. Military strategists in America do not have any desire to do this. They think it's a crazy idea. They don't want to do this. So in that sense, there's actually tension between the two allies. In other respects, Israel is an ally, but only potentially, because, as I said, it's very hard for it undermines any alliance that America wants to have with any Arab players in the region to be directly allied with Israel. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Let's get back to the Israeli. Israel does not seem to have themselves, they are not able to even consider the long-term solution. Policy has not changed, as you pointed out, since the birth of Zionism, actually. Tell us about what they're doing now and their sort of efforts to maintain control of the occupied territories.
Well, I think it's been the same policy for over a century, which is to accumulate as much land in historic Palestine as possible, making compromises when necessary. But the ideal goal is to settle as much land as possible. And these were the two big branches in Zionist history were the revisionists, who insisted no compromise, all of Palestine had to be conquered. And mainstream Zionism said, well, that may be an ideal end goal, but of course we have to compromise, and we have to settle for only a part of the land, and if we can, we'll get more of the land later. And I think mainstream Zionism has been, that's been the dominant trend. And I think what we have now is in practice, Israel is conquering the West Bank step by step, village by village, settlement by settlement, and it's this whole idea of a peace process is really something to basically prevent. I think it's really, from the Israeli perspective, it's useful to prevent any justice for Palestinians, any minimal justice for Palestinians, because they've been able to continue the settlement project from the very beginning. All through the mid-90s, settlements expansion continued. At the very height of the Oslo process, during the years of Labor Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, settlements expanded. And they've expanded after the Intifada broke out. So that's, whether the Prime Minister is a Labor, whether it's Likud, it doesn't really matter. The basic policy has stayed the same, which is to accumulate control, to solidify control over the West Bank.
And of course, what's appeared to be a failure, but who knows when it might begin succeeding, and to make life so miserable for Palestinians that they want to leave, that they'll emigrate somewhere else. And I suppose they also make it possible to leave quickly, but very difficult to get back in. They're continuing in that, I gather. That is just to squeeze Palestinians to make life more and more terrible in lots of ways.
It's true, but it's kind of a blind policy, because if you look at the demographic reality, there are something like 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel. There are something like 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, 1.5 million in Gaza. It's not, I mean, short of something that is truly cataclysmic, they're not going to be able to eliminate that population. And that's the fundamental contradiction of Israeli policy, whatever the government is. I don't think they have come to terms with the fact that there is a population rooted on the ground in Palestine, native inhabitants, that, you know, short of something bordering on genocidal expulsion, they're not going to be able to get rid of this population. And the current reality is apartheid, Israeli complete political domination and minimal to no rights for Palestinians. And that's not a workable solution for Israel. It's deeply destabilizing. And sure, they have all the power now. They've got the U.S. Congress in their pocket. They've got Washington firmly behind them. It seems that, you know, nothing can threaten their domination. But in the long term, it can't stand. And I think another aspect of these talks, the reason they're happening, is the worldwide movement to define Israel as an illegal occupying power and to punish them by, you know, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Israel does see that as a long-term threat. And I think the recent move by the European Union to divest from any Israeli entity that is involved in the West Bank is, it's a minimal step, but it's a very, very important indicator of what the BDS movement could accomplish in the future. Make no mistake about it, there is growing pressure in the world community to define the occupation as illegal and to censure Israel for this. There's growing understanding in the world community that Washington is not going to ever challenge Israel's occupation, and so a mass movement needs to do this. And that's what's happening. It's very slow, and it hasn't really affected diplomatic relations in a fundamental way yet, but it could in the future.
Yeah, the boycott, BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, in Europe it's further along than in the United States, but in the United States there have been real victories in the last year or so. And my guess is that it is that the Israelis are cognizant of it and very, very worried about it if it grows and strengthens. And they see South Africa, the success of sanctions in South Africa, of crippling the South African economy. Of course, South Africa is a very different state. It is a threat to them. Let me do a station ID, though. We have to end fairly soon. This is KABU Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Roan Carey, who's written several books on Israel-Palestine, co-edited and written many, many articles. You can find him on the by Googling Roan Carey, R-O-A-N-E-C-A-R-E-Y, at The Nation, and get the work he's see the work he's done. Roan, what do you see as the long-term future, both within Israel, is there a peace movement, and outside of Israel that through, I suppose, sanctions and divestment and boycott will actually come to influence Israeli policy?
Well, in the immediate future, I don't see any peace movement within Israel having any strength at all or any ability to influence the coalition government. The political powers in Israel, the party coalitions, have moved steadily to the right, and that's who is in charge now. And I think the BDS movement is not something that's going to change that in the short term at all. It might change it over the long term. There was a very interesting comment, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, before he left power, he publicly said, look, if we don't withdraw from the territories and allow a Palestinian state, we run the danger of becoming South Africa. And you know what that means. We become a world pariah. So I think the smartest Israeli politicians and strategists, wherever they come from on the political spectrum, they know that the South Africa example is there, and they know that if it ever really gains ground, then it could pose enormous difficulties, because a worldwide popular movement will put pressure on governments. The U.S. government will probably be the last government to change, but it was the last government to change on South Africa, too. It stood by South Africa until the divestment movement and the anti-apartheid movement finally forced divestment from South Africa. So I think Israelis understand, at least in principle, that this could be a threat. But the problem is that those who are willing to withdraw from the West Bank don't have the sense of urgency, and they don't have the political power inside Israel to push for it. Those who have the energy, those who have the passion, those who are determined tend to be the settler movement and the extremists. And in fact, they're putting even, you know, they're pushing through all sorts of measures in the Knesset that cut back on the rights of Palestinian citizens.
Right. Rowan, I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll have to keep reporting on Israel-Palestine, perhaps after these peace talks, whatever happens to them, to evaluate it. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Good talking to you, Bill. Take care.
Right. So long.
Okay. That was, again, Bill Resnick talking with Rowan Carey from The Nation magazine about Palestine and Israeli issues. This is Ivan Hale, and you're tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour, KBOO Portland. We have coming up today at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia is off today, so instead we will hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Dominique Kulikowski, a specialist in wildfires and disturbance ecology. We'll talk about how climate change is helping to shape new and more extreme fire regimes across the world. 11, it's Monday Morning Radio Zine with host Ren Green. Our guest will be Portland animator Kathy Hart, in to talk about her films on Native American eugenics and military sexual trauma. And at 11:30, continuing with the Monday Morning Radio Zine, host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with io9.com founder Annalee Newitz about her new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Up next, we have Kara Dugas, who will talk with us about the new Jim Crow and Trayvon Martin.
This past Thursday, on July 25th, there was a meeting arranged by the Portland International Socialist Organization and a new organization in Portland called Campaign to End the New Jim Crow, which aimed to help people come together and have some much-needed discussions about what racism looks like in our country. The Portland Campaign to End the New Jim Crow was inspired by Michelle Alexander's book, published in 2010, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. An excerpt from the foreword of the book, written by civil rights activist, philosopher, author, PhD, and many other things, Cornel West, reads, "While the age of Obama is a time of historic breakthroughs at the level of racial symbols and political services, Michelle Alexander's magisterial work takes us beyond these breakthroughs to the systemic breakdown of Black and poor communities devastated by mass unemployment, social neglect, economic abandonment, and intense police surveillance. Her subtle analysis shifts our attention from the racial symbol of America's achievement to the actual substance of America's shame, the massive use of state power to incarcerate hundreds of thousands of precious poor Black, male, and increasingly female young people in the name of a bogus, quote, war on drugs. And her nuanced historical narrative, tracing the unconscionable treatment and brutal control of Black people, slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration, takes us beneath the political surfaces and lays bare the structures of a racial caste system alive and well in the age of colorblindness. In fact, the very discourse of colorblindness, created by neoconservatives and neoliberals in order to trivialize and disguise the depths of Black suffering in the 1980s and 90s, has left America blind to the new Jim Crow. How sad is it that this blindness has persisted under both Republican and Democratic administrations and remains to this day hardly acknowledged or examined in our nation's public discourse? That was an excerpt of Dr. West's foreword to Alexander's book, which was also discussed and recommended for everyone to read during this meeting. With the recent acquittal of George Zimmerman, this meeting was also called to discuss Trayvon Martin, his murder, the public reaction to the trial and Zimmerman's acquittal, and Obama's speech on Trayvon and race. The meeting began with a short presentation during which many meaningful questions were raised, some including, why did it take Florida 44 days to charge Zimmerman after he killed Trayvon, but just over a month for the trial? Why was race a banned topic during the trial? And how would the trial and our country's reaction to it be different if Trayvon would have been a white teenager? After the presentation, we broke off into groups of about three to have some honest conversations about the trial. The group in which I was a part began by expressing our disappointment and shock to Zimmerman's acquittal. Even though racism has been prevalent in our judicial system since its creation, we were all still appalled at Zimmerman's acquittal, and none of us agreed with the verdict of the trial. Everyone in our group also seemed equally displeased with the recent speech given by Obama about Trayvon. We were glad that Obama had finally addressed the issue at length, but disappointed with his lack of a plan of action. Another topic our small group touched on was the Stand Your Ground laws and the fact that Oregon also has a Stand Your Ground law, although the language of the law in Oregon isn't exactly the same as Florida's. This came as a surprise to one of the members of our group, which made me wonder whether or not most Oregonians knew about the law and what we could do about that. Following our small group discussion, we came back together as a full group to hear each other speak. We acknowledged the things we had done so far in Portland to protest the trial, which were two rallies, one at Peninsula Park with about 500 people, and another in downtown in front of the courthouse. It was a consensus that both of these rallies had been productive and uplifting, but we wanted to do more. But before we plan to address all of these issues we're fighting related to the death of Trayvon Martin, we need to better understand what we're up against. Our society is by no means a post-racial one, and we must stop parading as such. A huge topic of discussion that I was glad we reached was our country's perception of race. Many people spoke up about the fact that race is a social construct, and that fact is too often ignored and denied by the people with the power to cause real and immediate change. Someone else spoke up about Obama and said he was just giving lip service to the issue. The question was implied over and over again. Why is our government, and specifically our president, not actively trying to stop the systemic racial injustices happening every day in our country? The group conversation then moved to offer an answer: money. Racism was created and is upheld in order for those in power to maintain their power, and in our global capitalist society, money equates with power, and in the most elite class, often supersedes race. We dwelled on this topic for a while because it is such a simple answer to such a complicated question. Another person spoke and said that racism cannot be completely destroyed under capitalism. I saw most people nod in agreement when it was said again that racism is much more about money than it ever was about the color of one's skin. A few black speakers chose to share some of the ways they had been racially profiled. One said that they had experienced people yelling racial slurs at them from their car multiple times and were told to, quote, go back to Africa. Another had been stopped by the police and arrested for just looking suspicious, a story we hear all too often. No community is immune to these issues. So what can we do to keep fighting racism? One speaker gave a detailed example of the type of revolution needed to end racial discrimination in our country. They said we need a new civil rights movement, one that is multiracial, multigender, one that spans generations, one that fights police brutality, mass incarceration, one that works with the labor movement, and one with serious organizational power. This is all true. We need a movement that doesn't shy away when our government refuses to acknowledge our struggle or when our media doesn't cover our protests. We need to keep supporting the people of color in our own communities and holding our own police and community members accountable when they perpetuate racial violence. We need to not let up until their victims receive justice, and we need to remember the people who have died from racial profiling in our own communities and across the world. If anyone is interested in checking out what Portland's campaign to end the New Jim Crow is doing, they can go to newjimcrow.wordpress.com or facebook.com/newjimcrowpdx. And to find out more about the Portland chapter of the International Socialist Organization, they can go to portlandsocialists.org. I encourage all who are interested to come out to future public meetings and share your opinions, as well as hear what others are saying and doing in the fight for a just and supportive democratic society, one that seeks to end racism and all forms of oppression. This has been Kara with the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for listening.
But don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim, and then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him. This is American justice. This is American democracy. If you can't prove that a democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
Yeah, well, the incomparable Malcolm X, Democracy is Hypocrisy. Before that, we had Kara Dugas on race and the New Jim Crow and how you can get involved in a local movement here in Portland. Up next, we have Paul Roland, who will be talking with us about the power of community radio.
No, man. Área 213, Super 365.
KJZ, the buzzer, KGD, WDCN, KUSF, Jet 94, KFRC,
And we have some more here.
These are the voices of modern industry. They speak the words that bring you together. These are the sound gears grinding. These are the loud levers. These are the sounds behind the machine. These are the voices of modern industry. These are the voices. These are the voices. These are the voices. K-Rock. K-Fan.
That's Modern Industry by Fishbone. Check out their video on YouTube. It's pretty brash. As I continue to explore the role and vital cultural space occupied by independent non-commercial radio, in particular the listener-sponsored community radio type of which KBOO is an example, I'd like to look more closely at the close connection between this kind of radio and social-political movements of resistance. When Pacifica launched KPFA in Berkeley in 1949, they were embarking in uncharted territory. KPFA began as a project of Lou Hill, his wife Joy, and a few of their friends. There had never really been anything like it. Supporting a station from listener contributions had never been tried. But the idea caught on, and within a decade, KPFA had become a vital part of an emerging dissident and experimental counterculture in the Bay Area. in the stultifying and repressive atmosphere of the Cold War era, embodied by the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, and Senator Joseph McCarthy, the station courageously broadcast a range of viewpoints almost entirely absent and excluded from the rest of the airwaves. And Pacific itself became a target of HUAC. Longtime program host William Mandel, an avowed communist as well as a man of strong moral principle, was called before the committee at the same time as local activists organized demonstrations against it, and KPFA was there to cover both the hearings and the protests. The documentary film KPFA on the Air, produced in 2000 by Veronica Silver and Sharon Wood, around the time of Pacifica's 50th anniversary, uses archival audio, film, and photos from that time to describe what happened. What you'll hear are portions of a Democracy Now! Broadcast of the film aired in 2009. Writer and activist Alice Walker, a strong supporter of KPFA and of free speech, is the film's narrator, and Amy Goodman provides some voiceover introductions of those speaking in the film.
In 1960, the House Committee on Un-American Activities arrived in San Francisco to investigate suspected subversives in the region, including Bill Mandel. KPFA was ready to cover the hearings with the latest technology, portable tape recorders.
Chris Koch.
The second day on the job, I walked in the morning, they handed me a tape recorder and said, listen, here's what you do. You push this button and this button, that's record. Hold the microphone about here. Go over to San Francisco. We've got to cover this.
There's a great deal of commotion outside these chambers, as you can hear. I have no idea what's going on.
The major core of the students are sitting on the upper stairwell. The police are on both sides of them. The police are taking them by the arms and hauling them bodily down the long stairway to the main floor.
The police have grabbed a Negro and are dragging him down the stairs.
William Mandel.
Honorable beaters of children and sadists uniformed and in plain clothes.
Distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman. Eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace. If you think I'll cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
Chris Koch.
The broadcast of the HUAC hearings mobilized the Bay Area community against HUAC. There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
Yes, Pacifica was a player in breaking the back of McCarthyism. The leaders of KPFA began saying, KPFA brings the listening public the other point of view, the point of view you don't normally hear elsewhere. People think that alternative media is this sort of abstract concept that was just invented out of somebody's hat. It wasn't. It was invented out of the political necessity that was created by the Cold War.
Dale Miner.
People were saying things that people were afraid to say, offering opinions that people were afraid to offer elsewhere.
We didn't take surveys, audience surveys. We didn't ask people what they wanted to hear. We programmed what we thought they should hear.
Dick Gregory.
You want to solve the problems in the black ghettos? Don't bring no money down there. You're going to have to do something first that won't cost you one nickel as far as black folks are concerned. And that is, for the first time in the history of America, you're going to have to create an atmosphere where black folks will trust white folks.
Freedom. Oh, freedom.
We got messed up too. We want freedom. I mean, more freedom. I want to know why did they blow up the house? Why did they blow up the house? We want freedom.
Most of our political reporting looked at issues that the rest of the media wasn't dealing with.
Chris Koch.
Poverty, peace issues, nuclear disarmament. If you wanted to turn to anything different than network news, your only place to go was Pacifica, was KPFA.
Pacifica was often the first or one of the first broadcasters to openly talk about issues that no one else would touch, opening up new social space and possibilities for suppressed and marginalized groups and viewpoints.
There have been 10 licenses revoked in this very Bay Area of bars and restaurants
simply on the grounds that a large number of homosexuals allegedly congregate in those places.
Have they any idea how they're going to remove the civil rights of one element in the population without removing everyone else's civil rights? What is to stop the police?
The person responsible for the station's bold public affairs programming throughout the 1960s was Elsa Knight Thompson. Trained by the BBC in wartime London, she arrived at KPFA ready to take charge.
You see, most liberals think that if you can find the middle of anything and squat there, that somehow or another virtue has been achieved.
I think if there is any possibility of saving democracy, that it rests with the media. Because the politicians are never going to tell you the truth. And the only way that people can cope is if there is some source of information that they learn to know that they can trust.
Lou Hill's model of independent listener-sponsored radio had proved not only viable, but had become an important social force. Other Pacifica stations had also been established, KPFK in L.A. in 1959 and WBAI in New York in 1960. But it was the well-established KPFA in Berkeley that once again was in the right place at the right time at an important historical moment, as Amy Goodman explains.
In 1964, students at the University of California, Berkeley staged a protest calling on the university administration to lift a ban on on-campus political activities that launched what came to be known as the free speech movement. This is Mario Savio, the leader of the student sit-ins.
My name is Mario Savio. I'm chairman of University Friends of SNCC. I've been one of the people who have been meeting with the deans here to see if we can have freedom of speech at the University of California.
KPFA had barely survived an attack on its own freedom of speech. It would now commit itself to bringing the students' cause to the larger community.
If the administration does not accept full political rights on this campus, we will be back for direct action until we have total democracy.
On December 1st, the free speech movement announced that a round-the-clock sit-in would be held in Sproul Hall.
We want all your support. This is everyone's issue. Get out. It's free speech. Fight them. Don't let them do this.
At 7 p.m., the doors were closed, and police announced that anyone who remained in the building did so in violation of the law.
You have 5 minutes to leave the building or you will be arrested.
I don't know what's happening to these kids, but it looks horrible. They're tugging them by their feet and throwing them down the stairs. One kid is now being pulled feet first down the stairs. Some other cops are grabbing him. We'll report it to the press.
By the time 800 students were arrested in December 1964, KPFA had become the voice of the student movement.
Police have ordered us to get out of the way until they've gotten this cleaned up.
And when student activists began to confront the war in Vietnam, KPFA's coverage fueled the movement's growing strength.
Dale Miner.
Pacifica was one of the earliest voices opposing the Vietnam War, asking critical questions of the Vietnam War, asking critical questions of American involvement there.
Behind the guns of the Vietmen.
Pacifica was invaluable in getting some of these things into the atmosphere.
You hook together political activists and cultural activists and an avant-garde and a bunch of really crazy people, and it was out of that mess that this synergy happened that created exciting things.
When the Three Mile Island nuclear accident occurred in 1979, once again KPFA stepped up to break the wall of silence. The accident and the independent media coverage of it led to a resurgent anti-nuclear movement, just as KABU had helped to invigorate the movement to shut down the Trojan nuclear power plant in our region.
Alan Snittow.
Suddenly, something went wrong.
All the details aren't in yet, but it appears a pump in the Three Mile Island reactor's cooling system broke down.
That particular moment when the reactor started to melt down, we went on the air, took everything else off the air on KPFA, and just went on continuous broadcast alert.
We have absolutely no question about the safety of nuclear plants as a result of this mishap. We do not refer to it as a nuclear accident because it was not that.
How can you say it's not an accident when radiation is being detected as far away as 16 miles?
Eileen Alfandari, who'd been working on these issues for a long time, called all of the nuclear engineers, all the people who'd done exposés of this industry and so forth.
It sounds like a very serious accident. Certainly they have a leak in the primary system. But it sounds like they've
And what we were saying was 100% opposite what the nuclear industry was saying and what was being reported on the media. And it really was a moment that showed the power of what this medium could be.
By 1977, the last two Pacifica stations, KPFT in Houston and WPFW in Washington, D.C., had been added to the network. In the late 1970s and early 80s, Pacifica also initiated a pre-internet news feed using telephones for distribution. While the news feeds went primarily to the Pacifica stations, some independent community stations like KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, and KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as well as our own KBOO, began to pick them up as well. These interconnections eventually led to the Pacifica Affiliates Network, of which KBOO became a member. Pacifica had already experimented with live national broadcasts all the way back in 1972 at the Democratic and Republican conventions in Miami, but it was the 1987 Iran-Contra hearings that really gained Pacifica national notoriety.
This nation cannot abide the communization of Central America.
Good morning and welcome to Pacifica Radio's live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings from Washington, D.C. I'm Larry Bensky in the Senate caucus room. Strangely enough, a hush has fallen over this room as Lieutenant Colonel North has entered.
I'll never forget after Iran-Contra in 1987, I was at some media event and a reporter came up from the all-news station. And he came up to me and he said, "You're Larry Bensky." He said, "I want to tell you, I listened to so much of that Iran-Contra, that's the best live broadcasting I ever heard."
Here's the opening gavel, and
I don't take it so much as personal praise, but how wonderful it is, despite all the poverty we have and all the internal aggravation of Pacifica, that we have this freedom to cover stories and expose the illegitimate uses of power.
KBOO Radio was born in 1968 out of a new wave of independent community stations begun by Crab in Seattle in 1962. As a child of the 60s, it did its share to reflect and amplify the social ferment of the times, covering the Portland State University student strike in 1970 in reaction to the U.S. invasion of Cambodia and other important concerns of the day. A more thorough look at KBOO's role in the history of post-1960s social movements is beyond the scope of this piece. I know that since I got involved in the late 1980s, KBOO has played a major role in the Northwest Forest Protection Movement, Native American fishing rights, the rapid expansion of bicycle-friendly transportation in Portland, organic agriculture and local food culture, opposition to genetically modified foods, gay marriage rights, and countless other social, political, and environmental issues. And when Occupy burst on the scene a couple years ago, KBOO was there as well, covering it live from the Occupy camp. In my first piece for The Old Mole on Community Radio last month, featuring an interview with Norm Stockwell of WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, Norm talked about the vital role WORT played during the uprising at the state capitol. I'll leave you with a brief talk by Molly Stentz, also with WORT, their news facilitator, that she gave at the 2011 National Conference on Media Reform about the power of community radio.
It was definitely the imagining of the possible that sparked the imaginations of people in Madison and across Wisconsin. And in fact, I feel like the other story that's not being told is what Wisconsin has inspired in other states, the occupation in the Washington Capitol. We've seen this in Michigan, Washington, Ohio. I mean, things are happening. It's not getting the coverage that Wisconsin got because they don't have the people, they don't have the same numbers. But it's been incredibly inspiring. So these things really do matter, the coverage. And the only thing I wanted to say about community media, it's so vital that if you have a local station in your community, that you give it support. Because the reason that we were able to do coverage was because 35 years ago, members of our community in Madison had the foresight to create the station then that exist today that pushed out the coverage. We were there every day because our station was six blocks from the state capitol, and we had the infrastructure, and we had the ability to respond immediately. We had the connections. We started doing stories. You know, we had reporters from around the country coming to us, you know, using our studios. We had film crews, TV crews, radio crews, producers from NPR stations, from community radio stations. You know, we had the BBC calling us in, what's going on in Wisconsin, you know? And we were able to push the stories out of local people because we were there, because we had the infrastructure. And so the time to respond to a crisis with coverage is not after the fact. You need to have that infrastructure in your community so that you will be able to cover the story. So if you have a community radio station or an independent station or independent press or independent magazines, you have to support that in your community if you want it to be there for you when these struggles happen in your community. That's my plug.
Molly Sense. Molly Sense from WRIT.
Well, that's it for another spotlight on the history and importance of community radio. For the Old Mole, this is Paul Roland. K-Rock, K-Fat, K-Ball, K-Zap, K-Soul, K-Shack, Chesterfield, W-Hot, M-Hot, ah, 294, K-I-C.
Been hanging out down south of hell, playing to the music of a broken bell. Hard times and beating myself up inside my head. I was the walking wounded or the living dead. Tie a yellow ribbon around my brain. My mind booked, it's been gone so long. Rash traveling with mad and insane. Tears fell like tears, rain fell like rain. Shadow Man called, catch me if you can. Knowing he can't be caught, he's the Shadow Man. Trickster turned free into junk and a rubber room. And Junkie Fix has even stolen from the moon. Leaders know they can't trust ones who follow. Followers know not to trust ones who lead. Love, hate, despair, and promises turn narcotic. If everything's normal, in reality psychotic. Claiming to understand dimension and space, Babylon huffs and puffs, bullying around in the natural order, temptation rules in the valley of fools. Celestial cannibals feast on essence, the civilized hide out from their lives, the traumatized worry about everything, hypnotized, worrying into nothing at all. Been hanging out down south of hell, playing to the music of a broken bell. Hard times and beating myself up inside my head. I was the walking wounded or the living dead.
Okay, that was John Trudell with South of Hell. Before that, we heard Paul Roland with an excellent piece on the power of community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're drawing to a close. We've heard some poetry today, also from Palestinian poet Somaye, who started off the show. Of course, Malcolm X in the middle there, and closing out with John Trudell. I want to thank you all very much for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour today. Remember, you can hear the Old Mole Variety Hour in parts of it or all of it by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour or liking us on Facebook, and you can get all or parts of our show downloaded directly into your Facebook account. Tell your friends, leave us a comment. Today's show will be up in a day or two. Everybody have a great week and see you next week. Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO, at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview with Professor Tom Herschel about new reports that finds 4 out of 5 U.S. adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein explores how climate change is helping to shape new and more extreme fires across the world, with Dominic Kulikowski, a specialist in wildfires and disturbance ecology. At 11, Ren Green talks to Portland animator Kathy Hart about her films on Native American eugenics and military sexual trauma. And at 11:30, the guest io9.com founder, Annalie Newitz, about her new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Thanks, KBOO members, for supporting this community radio station. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Afghanistan. Obama talks withdrawal while over 100,000 U.S. and NATO troops remain alongside an equal number of contractors. While the most intense fighting since 2001 rages out of control. Fleeing Afghans make up the largest refugee asylum-seeking population in the world today. Tune in to Political Perspectives Wednesday morning, July 31st at 9 a.m. Professor Zahair Wahab, returning from 5 months in Kabul training teachers, will join me, Linda Olson.